Hello and welcome to the Slightly Fox podcast from Hoxton Square in East London. If you're new to the podcast, welcome and thank you for joining us. As regular listeners will know, we record this around the kitchen table at this little publishing house. And all around us, the rest of the team are getting on with their day job of producing this very beautiful literary quarterly magazine known as Slightly Fox. So you may well hear them typing away or indeed making their lunch, as it is that sort of time here in London. Now, last month, Hazel and I talked about the art of travel writing with the author Sarah Wheeler and Barnaby Rogerson of Elan Books. And it was a good discussion, wasn't it?
Extremely, yes, and very adventurous travellers.
Yes, particularly yes. Sarah. Yes. Antarctic travel.
Yes.
This time we are staying closer to home and discussing garden writing. And we have both the Slightly Fox editors here today. Gail, we missed you last time, and the dogs.
Yes, I've been down in Devon for the past couple of weeks, and I'm very sad to report that Chudley is currently in disgrace
really?
For having eaten Easter eggs and having an emergency visit to the vet.
Chocolate and dogs,
I know,
not being
it
a good
was
thing.
Not, in fact, we had three dogs staying and we didn't know which dog was the culprit, so we had to take all three of them to the vet.
That was an expensive
ghastly,
Easter.
Ghastly scene, yes. Anyhow, all is well.
I'm glad to hear it. And what's going on here?
We are in the middle of finalising the proofs for the autumn issue. We've had to cram in quite a lot this time, so a fair amount of cutting has been going on.
Yes, we've got a very interesting piece on Olivia Manning's Balkan trilogy, which is, you know, somewhat forgotten, I think, but it's really fascinating.
There's a piece on Dorothy Sayers' Gaudy Night, a lovely piece on Learning to Read Under the Piano by Tim McIntosh Smith, and something on Tennyson's In Memoriam.
Packed.
Yes, yeah. And also Lord Allenbrook's diaries. I hadn't realised he'd had such a terrible time with Churchill. Yes.
He was chief of staff throughout the war and so had immense responsibility and had to cope with Churchill in all his many guises. So that all sounds rather serious. We've actually got a delightful piece on Roald Dahl's memoir Boy, which is enchanting and has a lot about sweet shops and ghastly headmasters.
When's that issue out?
September.
Okay, and there's books, quite a lot of books coming out.
We have. We're reissuing a couple of books which have sold out, so we're putting them into plain Fox editions. 84 Charing Cross Road, and also the first volume in Adrian Bell's Suffolk farming trilogy, Corduroy.
Oh, lovely. So, yes. Rural books, actually. I read, you recommended in a previous podcast, the Tim, is it Pears or Pears?
Pears.
Pears.
The trilogy.
Fantastic.
It is. I've been giving it to people left, right and centre.
It's a great recommendation.
You're settling down to a lot of reading as well, Gail and I, on the lookout for more memoirs to reissue. We're always open to suggestions.
You two have a very nice job in some ways, don't you?
Yes.
We read a lot more memoirs than we ever choose.
The only problem is it does eat into other reading time. I think only about 1 in 10 makes the cut.
Yeah,
surprising.
So actually I can see there's quite a lot of wading through.
There is a lot
stuff.
Of wading through, and I'm afraid that if you get to page 50 and it's not really doing it for you, then out it goes.
Well, my name is Philippa Lamb. We're looking at garden writing this time. I think it's fair to say enthusiastic amateur probably covers most of us. We are fortunate to have two thoroughly expert guests, Ursula Buchan and Matt Collins. Our essay reading from the Slightly Foxed archive this time is about one of the great British garden writers, Christopher Christo Lloyd, the man who put the gardens at his family home, Great Dixter, in East Sussex, on the international map. We will, of course, also have book recommendations, but now, Gail?
Yes, well, I'm very pleased indeed, Ursula, to see you here. Ursula Buchan, for many years, she was a garden columnist on The Spectator and the author of a lot of other books on gardening. Esther, I know you read history at Cambridge. How did you get into gardening?
Well, that's quite an odd story, really. My mother died when I was 15, so I took over looking after the family garden. And, in fact, I'd always enjoyed gardening with her. I was one of six children, and it was the best way to get her on her own. And so by the time I got to Cambridge, I was actually pretty knowledgeable for a teenager, I think. And after university, I wasn't quite sure what I was going to do, but I knew I was going to write. So I went to work for Nancy Lancaster at Little Haseley, famous gardener, just doing a holiday job. But I enjoyed it so much that I carried on and I trained for a year the RHS Gardens at Wisley, and then 3 years at the Royal Botanic Gardens, Kew. And while I was still at Kew, I started to contribute to magazines, in particular the RHS Journal.
And when did you start writing for The Spectator?
I wrote for a local newspaper, and then I just wrote to Charles Moore when he first became editor. There wasn't a gardens column. There never had been, not since 1828 when it was founded. So he took me on as a monthly contributor, and I was there for 26 years and loved it.
How did you sustain it for so long?
It's funny, when you have a column, you find yourself thinking all the time. And I'd only have to go out into the garden and something would occur to me.
And would spark your interest.
Yes.
And I know that some of the pieces were collected in a couple of books with rather delightful titles, weren't they?
Yes. Well, there was, first of all, Good in a Bed, and second, Better Against a Wall. And that's an old nurseryman's joke. It was about a rose called Lady Hillingdon. And it appeared in a nursery catalogue during the First World War. Oh, Lady Hillingdon was very keen on roses, but she is also known to history as the woman who is supposed to say, when Charles comes and visits me at night, I lie back and think of England.
Oh, really?
So it was, they were very sort of ironic.
Yes.
And some reviewers thought it was actually rather coarse. It certainly got me noticed.
Well, we've got a second guest with us here today, Matt Collins, who's head gardener at the Garden Museum in Lambeth. Matt, tell me how you got into gardening, because it wasn't quite the same route as Ursula, was it?
No, not entirely. I'd finished studying history of art at university and found myself outpriced from returning to London to start working. So I moved back to my parents in rural Wales, where they had subsequently moved, and just found myself completely, I suppose, a bit lost in the landscape. I didn't really know very much about what I was looking at. My mother's a great gardener, and she sort of always inspired me growing up. But it was really just to start to understand the natural world a little bit more, and that very quickly inspired a love of gardening.
I'm intrigued you two both started young, because you don't think of gardening as a thing for youngsters, do you? Well, I don't.
I think that the growth area, such as it is in people changing careers, people realising in their 20s or 30s that actually gardening is what they really want to do. And so they're going back to places like Kew to train. And people are not encouraged at school. And it's strange, because gardening, if done well in the way that Matt does it at the Garden Museum, is intellectually very demanding. It's science, it's art. And people try hard to promote gardening as a proper profession, but it's very hard to get the school's careers people to take it seriously.
Do you think it should be started very young? Do you think that's when it really takes?
Yes, I think so. And I think that is one very good development in the last few years. School gardens are much better than they were.
Yes.
Understanding where food comes from.
Well, I think nostalgia is the great drive for garden writing in general. I mean, most garden writers still refer to things that they experienced when they were very young.
And children,
it really drives that kind of writing, I think.
Mm. So where did you train, Matt?
When back in Wales, I took up a course at the Botanic Gardens in Wales.
Where are they?
They're in Carmarthenshire. A really good experience there for a year, and then came back to London and started working in garden maintenance. And then stumbling upon this place called the Garden Museum, which was set inside a decommissioned church in Lambeth and had been saved from dereliction by someone called Rosemary Nicholson, because there are these tombs in the garden.
Is it the Tredescans?
John the Elder Tredescan was gardener to Charles I, and he was one of Britain's first plant hunters who travelled the world, particularly around America, to bring back exotic plants and have them on display in his garden and then for the gardens in which he was commissioned.
And it's a very historic bit of London, isn't it? Because you're by the Archbishop's
Palace. We're right
palace,
by Lambeth
aren't
you? Palace.
Yeah.
We get a lot of footfall for people confused of where the palace is. So that's good. That works
Andy.
In my favour.
So what's in the museum? I haven't been.
Well, it's a collection of all sorts. So we have a temporary exhibition space.
You've got Ivan Hitchens.
We have currently got Ivan Hitchens,
which
is
wonderful.
Yeah, fantastic. Yeah. And that runs until the end of July. We've had Cedric Morris and a really interesting sort of garden crossover painters who are very much influenced by their own garden and their paintings. And then we have a permanent exhibition that's upstairs, and that contains amazing things from artifacts belonging to important and significant gardeners, from Gertrude Jekyll's desk to Alan Titchmarsh's jumper, things like that.
But the history of the plant finders, though, is fascinating, isn't it? Because so many of them wrote really rather wonderful accounts of their travels.
Yes, well, the Tredescans were like that, but I mean, all through the 19th century and into the 20th, British explorers went all over the world finding suitable plants for British gardens, particularly the Himalayas, where all those wonderful rhododendrons and magnolias that
you grow in. Oh, and
the
Himalayan poppy as well.
Exactly, yes. That grow in Cornish and Devonian gardens and the west coast of Scotland as well, where the Gulf Stream is. Reginald Farrar, for instance, famous plant hunter and writer of overripe prose. Frank Kingdon Ward was another one who wrote a number of books on his plant hunting. And you're there, you're gripped, you're looking for the source of the Brahmaputra and all the rest of it. Yes. Fascinating.
I remember one of my very first gardening books that I say edited is probably not the right word, but had a hand in, and it took me quite a long time to figure out that the Latin names, Forestii and Douglasii and so on and so forth, of course, referred to the people that actually found the plants.
Certainly did, George Forrest and David Douglas, yes.
I recently was trying to read through quite a lot of David Douglas's diaries of exploring the Pacific Northwest, and it gives you a whole other perspective when these familiar plants that you know so well are being talked about in this way that's so original and first discoveries. It's a lovely way to read travel writing, yeah. Actually.
And dangerous too. I mean, poor David Douglas fell into a pit where there was a bull and was gored to death.
Oh my goodness.
And Reginald Farrar died of bronchial pneumonia on his own in Burma. It wasn't for sissies.
We have a wonderful game, a computer game for children who come to the museum where you get to be a plant hunter and choose your apparatus for collecting plants, choose your voyage, choose your ship, and then hopefully make it back with some plants alive. But every single time I've tried it, I've come to some catastrophic end. Yeah, it's a very hard game, but good fun.
I mean, was this a peculiarly English thing, or were there plant hunters from all nations of the world?
Oh, there were. Russians and Germans and French. And quite a lot of them were missionaries, in fact. Davidia involucrata, which is a wonderful Chinese plant, was first discovered by a man called Père David.
Is that the handkerchief tree?
Yes.
I've just planted one.
Oh, well, good luck. It'll be a few years before it flowers.
Yeah.
So when did garden writing, as we think of it now, really start?
I think probably the kind of garden writing that we can really respond to started with William Robinson and Gertrude Jekyll in the second half of the 19th century. Would you agree about that?
Absolutely, yeah. Wood in Garden, isn't it? Gertrude Jekyll.
And is it The Wild Garden, William Robinson?
And William Robinson, yeah.
Oh, and yes, what's the other William Robinson book? The English Flower Garden,
yes.
It's called, isn't it? Which came out in 1870, I think, and went on. I think it was still being produced after the Second World War. Unbelievably influential.
Presumably at that stage, the Victorian middle classes had time and leisure and indeed staff, and they were the audience for these
indeed,
books.
Yes, the burgeoning middle class were very important. And William Robinson had a magazine, a newspaper called The Garden, that Gertrude Jekyll contributed to. So for the first time, really, it was becoming a sort of mass occupation, even if the homeowners didn't necessarily...
I was going to say they had staff, yes.
Well, both those writers had such strong opinions, didn't they? They were very forthright. I mean, William Robinson had a real bugbear about Victorian planting schemes, all these awful schemes of bedding, which he supposed you could replace entirely with exotics that would fit quite naturally into the British landscape. But same as Gertrude Jekyll, they have these very strong-willed, almost kind of preacher-like rhetoric that I think reading garden books you quite like, you quite want.
You sort of want somebody with opinions, even if you disagree with them, don't you?
Certainly, you want someone to tell you how to do it and how not to do it, like listening to a good preacher or a good, being at church.
Rise very strong passions.
Yes.
Sort of fashions in gardens.
Yes, indeed they did. And William Robinson and Reginald Blomfield, who was very much an advocate of the sort of bedding out kind of gardening. He and William Robinson had a tremendous up and downer. They properly got really cross with each other in public and in print. And it affected people's attitudes hugely. And so the ideas that we think are quite modern, the idea of the natural meadow and the wild garden and things, all comes from Robinson and Jekyll. We've been doing this for, I don't know, very long time.
Yeah. What about Marjorie Fish?
Oh, well, she's a very important post Second World War figure.
She's later.
Yes. We Made a Garden, I think, came out in the early 60s or the late 50s. They had this garden called East Lambrook Manor in Somerset. And she very much did her own gardening. Mm. And she was very keen on the cottage garden. I mean, a sophisticated cottage garden type of planting, which Gertrude Jekyll had been advocating. So Jekyll's influence on gardens lasted, I should think, nearly 100 years. It's fading now because in the last 20 years there have been some new ideas in gardening.
Yes.
But until, I don't know, the 70s or 80s, people were still making Gertrude Jekyll gardens.
And then, of course, we obviously need to mention Harold Nicholson and Vita Sackville-West.
Yeah, Vita took on the mantle, really, didn't she, at that point, from the likes of William Robinson and Gertrude Jekyll, and then led quite neatly on to sort of a later period of wonderful writing where Beth Chatto and Christopher Lloyd picked up. And
They were influenced by Vita Sackville-West, very much. Yes. She wrote the Observer column on gardening from 1946 to 1960.
She wrote a very long poem called The Garden as well, didn't she?
Yes, she did. Yes. One called The Land and one called The Garden. Yeah. And she was a sort of gardening writing superstar, really, in those years after the Second World War. And Sissinghurst is still probably the most well-loved garden in England. And Harold Nicholson was the sort of brains behind the laying it out. And Vita did the planting, and they were a very creative couple. Mm.
Like a lot of gardens, it's that romantic pairing, isn't it, between the architecture and the garden.
You have to get the skeleton before you can put the flesh
very
on.
Very much so, very much so.
And didn't she used to write in the tower?
She did, and that's been preserved as more or less as she
left
it. Yes,
the Tudor Tower, absolutely.
Well, we've been talking about, by implication, trees and shrubs and flowers. But what about vegetables? I'm thinking, Ursula, you wrote a wonderful book about British gardening during the Second World War.
Oh, yes, A Green and Pleasant Land.
Which obviously had a great deal to say about vegetable growing and digging for victory.
Yes, it did. And I discovered through my research that the Dig for Victory campaign had not been nearly as successful as the government tried to make it out to be. And it's made no difference to people's attitudes at all. People still think the Dig for Victory campaign was
remarkable. But a lot of gardens must have been dug up to grow.
And parks, yes, indeed. But I mean, a lot of people would pass them by for all sorts of reasons.
We were certainly told that it was this national endeavour that everyone embraced, but that didn't happen.
But the government had a propaganda battle to win.
Interesting.
And it did encourage people, because even if people didn't garden themselves, they liked to think that other people did. And keep chickens and pigs and everything else. And there were some very good stories. It was ordinary people battling in extraordinary circumstances. And it was amazing what people did do.
I suppose a lot of the allotments that are still going survive from then.
Quite a lot, yes. Though it was amazing how many were taken back after the war for housing. It was very difficult gardening during the war, though, because you couldn't get manure and you couldn't get potash, because that was mined almost entirely in Germany and Poland. Tools were very in short supply. So, you know, it was hard graft. And the allotments weren't fenced, so there was a lot of thieving. Which, again, is not a story.
I was going to say, glossed over. So, after the war, I mean, we've mentioned Marjorie Fish. Who else would both of you rate as garden writers?
There's Graham Stuart Thomas, who was a great post-war writer.
I met him once, actually. We published a revised version of his book on roses, and he by then in his late 80s, and he would turn up at, this is at John Murray's offices, with a small yellow rose in his lapel, which was the Graham Thomas rose.
Well, he was a fantastic writer, and he wrote a really wonderful essay detailing sort of the, again, in a very William Robinson kind of style, going back against the nature of over-cultivation and over-breeding in plants. And so I wish I could remember the name now, but it's a wonderful essay just sort of detailing how the simple flower is the master, and that you can't better it.
Of course, that we feel is a very modern view, because single flowers tend to be much more attractive to pollinators. Yeah. I mean, if there has been a change in the way we've gardened in the last 20 years, it has been towards a much more ecological approach, more sustainable. There's been a sea change, and that has been promoted by the modern garden writers, people like Anna Pavord, Christopher Lloyd, of course, with his meadow, Beth Chatto. We haven't mentioned Beth Chatto, and she is very important in this.
We've got an article coming in Slightly Fox on Beth Chatto.
Very good.
Because it's only recently that she died.
Last year, I think.
She and her husband were very, very interested in where plants came from and how they grew in their natural habitat. And she carried that through in rather unlikely circumstances, a sort of clay field in very dry rural Essex. Mm. And she learnt how to deal with plants that like dry conditions and also woodland conditions as well. And she wrote very winningly. And perhaps one of the best books that came out of all of that was her letter exchange with Christopher Lloyd. I think it's called Dear Gardener. And there you have two garden writers and gardeners at the top of their game exchanging ideas. Mm. So, I mean, there are still good garden writers, but the emphasis has rather changed.
I suppose television inevitably has changed people's perception of who's worth paying attention to.
Monty Don is a very good writer, And Carol Klein is good as well. So and just because you're on the telly, it doesn't mean that you can't write.
No, not quite. I'm interested also in books about trees. And, I know, Matt, your book was called Forest,
isn't
it?
It's called Forest, yes. Yeah, it was a really wonderful commission. We'd suggested this idea, I say we, myself and the photographer, Rue Lewis, of just connecting familiar British trees with their woodland equivalents in various other parts of the world. So an oak tree in England and then an oak tree in America, let's say, and sort of follow its forest path and explore what a tree is when it's in a forest as opposed to as a single
specimen. That sounds fascinating. One of my favourite books, well, I have two favourite books on trees. Well, one is Thomas Packenham's Remarkable Trees. And the other is Hugh Johnson's Book of Trees, which is my kind of Bible. Yeah.
He's another very good writer worth looking out. And he, for many years, wrote as Tradescant, in the RHS Journal. And he's a thoroughly cultivated and very knowledgeable.
And he now writes for Hortus, which is a wonderful quarterly journal on gardening and full of amazing garden writers.
Dear David Wheeler, who runs Hortus, gave me the idea for the format of Slightly Foxed.
Did he? Because, yes, you can see
and
the
gave me a great deal of very helpful practical advice when we first started.
Yeah, he's fantastic. He gave me one of my first sort of garden writing opportunities through Hortus. Mm.
But it's funny with books on trees, I suppose, because, you know, human lifespan being what it is, and trees, obviously, many trees, you know, far outlive us, that so often you read, for example, the Dawn Redwood, people still don't know just how tall it's going to become in England because it was only planted in 1940.
Yes,
1946.
Exactly.
But the idea of posterity should be an appealing one. Absolutely. We shouldn't just think, oh, my Davidian involucrata will flower in my lifetime.
They live on a different timescale.
They do, completely, don't they?
Like the great landscape designers of the past, the Capability Browns, who never saw their creation.
Exactly. Yeah. Your Capability Brown landscape is looking probably at its best. It may be just going over, actually. Some of those beaches are falling down.
I always
down
think
now.
That when I go and see those landscapes.
And he wouldn't have seen it.
Nothing at all in the vicinity of what it looks like now.
Yeah. I said my last question to you both is about vegetables, because I've just got a greenhouse and a couple of raised beds. And I would like to know who is worth reading on growing vegetables.
Would it still be fair to say Joy Larkham is the...
She's the doyenne, yes. Though I don't think she writes anymore. She
did Oriental Vegetables?
Yes. Her books are available. You can find them. Oh. And she went to such trouble to learn. She trialled enormous numbers of vegetables. And so you can really trust her, I would say, wouldn't you, Matt?
Absolutely. Being locked away in your greenhouse reminds me of a William Cobbett, a very forthright book on setting out your vegetable patch, again, with sort of grander ideas about space and how much you could fit in. I think it's in the English Gardener he wrote, "It is better to be in the greenhouse than blubbering over a stupid novel."
Yes. I must admit that when I'm sitting down in Devon editing a particularly intractable article for Slightly Foxed, I have learnt that the best thing to do is to walk away from my desk and go and talk to the vegetables in my greenhouse, and then half an hour later when I go back to my desk, all is clear and the problem is easily solved.
Absolutely.
I think we all find that.
Well, this seems like a perfect moment to draw this really fascinating conversation to a close.
Well, thank you both so much for coming.
It's
I could talk
creepy.
About gardens for
think
hours.
Our pleasure, don't you think, Matt?
Yes, absolutely.
Let's move on to this month's piece from the Slightly Foxed Archive. Hazel, tell us what we're going to hear this time.
Well, it's a piece from issue 59, and it's by Michael Liepman, who had an allotment himself and wrote about it in The Times. And he's writing about the garden writings of Christopher Lloyd,
of
who
Great Dixter,
who we've
about,
been talking about now.
There is no good reason why an expert gardener should be able to write elegant prose. And a survey of the gardening shows of bookshops will confirm that the two skills rarely converge. One glittering exception was Christopher Lloyd, known familiarly as Christo, who died in 2006, having spent almost his entire adult life developing the five-acre garden at his family home in Great Dixter, East Sussex. Although he was deadly serious about gardening, his writing was always unstuffy, telling us almost as much about him and his acquaintances as about his plants and preferences. He would use the reactions of others to clarify his own ideas. The very first sentence of his best-known book, The Well-Tempered Garden, hints at this. "Friends sometimes ask me to deliver post-mortems on their less successful gardening efforts, but it is very difficult to pronounce with any certainty when their case history has been thoroughly masked." This slightly irritable tone, bordering on the curmudgeonly, permeates much of his writing and is part of what makes it fun to read. The Well-Tempered Garden is today recognised as a classic of the genre, yet the essence of Christo's approach is more sharply delineated in his numerous columns. He wrote for Country Life unfailingly every week for 43 years. A selection was published in 1993 under the title In My Garden. In 1989, he began a column for The Guardian, which continued until shortly before he died. Some of these were collected in Cuttings in 2007. As it happens, 1993 was also the year when I first became acquainted with him. He had been born into gardening. My own belated introduction to the craft was very different. In 1974, I was editor of the diary column in The Times. It was the year of the long miners' strike, resulting in power cuts and, briefly, the 3-day working week. All that brought on a general feeling that we were approaching the end of civilization as we knew it. Self-sufficiency became the watchword, and there was a sudden surge in demand for allotments. To test how hard it was to acquire one, I put in an application to several bodies and wrote a diary item about their discouraging responses. Then forgot all about it. A year later, I received a letter from the Thames Water Authority inviting me to take over an allotment outside their Brixton waterworks. I decided to take the plunge so that I could write occasional diary items on the travails of a novice gardener. These quickly caught the imagination of readers, who sent me letters of encouragement and advice, as well as seeds and cuttings. I was even persuaded to write a book about it. As a result, before long I was approached by editors to write about gardens, adding an extra string to my journalistic bow. Christo was never averse to challenging received opinion, and in April 1993 he hit the headlines by announcing in Country Life that he was going to uproot nearly all the roses from his historic rose garden, designed in 1912 by the architect Edwin Lutyens, and replace them with lush, tropical-style plants. Seeing that the soil is excellent for any other plant except for the rose, which has fouled its own patch, he wrote, I do not see why I should be made a slave to this one flower, which occupies no greater a place in my affections than many another. Some critics were horrified, pointing out that a bed of roses has long been seen as an essential component of the traditional English garden. Would its abandonment by one of the nation's leading plantsmen lead to its eventual demise? In the wake of this controversy, I was asked by the magazine Gardens Illustrated to interview the great man. I did so with trepidation. Given the ferocity with which he expressed his opinions, I assumed he would be a crusty, tetchy bachelor. On the contrary, he turned out to be a complete charmer, the very reverse of irascible, although determined not to bend before the gales of criticism provoked by his assault on our national flower. This was just one of the ways in which he defied horticultural correctness. He consistently advised gardeners to follow their own preferences rather than act as slaves to fashion. Your novice upper class or upper middle class or yuppie class gardener will be terrified of doing the wrong thing, he wrote in one of his Guardian columns, of growing the wrong plants, of combining them stridently, and worst of all, of being commented on adversely by friends and acquaintances whom they regard as important. Hence the asphyxiating boredom born of the good taste gardener, who hasn't a fresh idea in his or her head, or any desire to develop one. In the Well-Tempered Garden, he vents his disdain too for the tribe of gardening experts. He was presumably unaware that, on the strength of that very book, he was soon to be counted among them.
Yes, indeed.
And you met him, didn't you, Esther?
Yes, I knew him reasonably well for many years. And one thing you do have to say about him is, though he could be irascible and he could be grumpy, he was extremely kind to young people, particularly if they were keen on gardening and plants. And there are a number of gardeners who have a lot to thank him for, because not only was he a marvellous gardener with a fantastically acute sense of observation, but he was a very hospitable host who would cook, and you know, people stayed there, and the result is that there are many people who hold him in great reverence, really, and great dicks to the garden under the tutelage, particularly of his last head gardener, Fergus Garrett, just goes from strength to strength.
And I love the fact that he dismissed that idea of being prescriptive about planting.
Yes.
Because certainly when I started dabbling in gardening, this idea that some plants were apparently, you were just not permitted to have them. They weren't good taste, or they weren't done. Or I hated all that. And it was lovely that he just said, it's nonsense, plant what you like.
It's very much the ethos at Dixter that's continued, is trying out any plant in any sort of position.
I think he probably had the most influence on post-Second World War gardeners and gardeners, because it was a very changed world after the Second World War, and a great many people like Christopher, who was from the upper middle classes, they had to think in terms of gardening themselves, because a lot of the labour just disappeared. And you did have a lively tradition of what's now called the Chatty Garden Book by cultured, educated people who were also keen gardeners and got their fingernails dirty.
And as Hazel said, that was some Michael Leitman's essay, which appeared in, I think, September last year, wasn't it, 2018?
Yes.
People can buy single issues, can't they,
if they wanted to read the whole thing. Yes, we keep all the back issues in stock.
And I should say, it was beautifully read for us, as ever, by the actor Nigel Anthony. Now, book recommendations shortly. First, a quick word about the Slightly Fox Quarterly magazine. Elegant and entertaining, Slightly Foxed is the literary quarterly for non-conformists. It introduces readers to all those wonderful books that languish on publishers' backlists but disappear from bookshops. Its contributors are established writers, journalists, and people from many fields. They all share their passion for particular books and authors, and since it's entirely independent, Slightly Foxed is free to follow its own nose and celebrate the offbeat. So why not take out a subscription? Happily, it's a bargain. £48 for a year's print subscription and free access to all the back issues in the digital archive. Here's the web address, foxedquarterly.com. Or if you'd rather talk to a human, give Hattie a call. She's on 020 7033 0258. Thank you. Yes, recommended reads from everyone, please. Ursula.
Well, I've been enjoying The Diary of a Bookseller by Sean Bithell, I think that's how you pronounce it. He's a bookseller in Wigton in Galloway, which is known as the book town, and has a highly regarded book festival. And Sean Bithell is not unlike Christopher Lloyd in a way. He's very opinionated, sometimes a bit grumpy, but can be extremely funny. And he is very good on the trials and tribulations of being a second-hand bookseller in the world of Abe Books and Amazon. So I thoroughly recommend it.
Matt?
If I may recommend two, I would suggest on garden writing wise, I've just read a wonderful book by Beth Lynch about the process of being bereft of a garden and slowly sort of finding one in Switzerland. So it's about a move and sort of the loss of her garden and then finally getting that space to garden in. And it's incredibly beautifully written and very articulate on that sense of loss, which doesn't often get written about.
You're right, it's such a hard thing.
A hard thing.
When you leave your garden.
Yes.
I did it myself about 3 years ago. It's awful.
the sort of physical need to garden. And then I've just finished reading another Eland book by Jonathan Raban called Old Glory, which is just about his voyage down the Mississippi from Minnesota down to Louisiana. And it's just stunning writing. It was written in the 80s, and it's a wonderful take on the culture and the sort of river towns that flow all the way down through America.
Hazel.
Well, I'm reading The Letters of Penelope Fitzgerald, I think it's called, And So I Think of You. And you don't really have to be even a Penelope Fitzgerald fan to enjoy them. They're edited by her son-in-law, and I think there could have been a little bit more help with who everybody is. She came from a very academic blue stocking family, and she's rather austere, but she's also very funny and very, very observant. And of course, her own life, I suppose, looked at from one angle, was a kind of car crash. You know, she lived in tremendous poverty, really, in council flats and on a boat that sank off Battersea, which all appear, of course, in her books. But they're absolutely fascinating and very affectionate, and you just sort of lose yourself in this atmosphere. I suppose that's why I love letters.
Gail.
We've been talking about gardens, and I'm in the middle of a book, which is the antithesis, really. It's called Wilding by Isabella Tree, and it's about how she and her husband gave up intensive farming down in Sussex and first of all turned the park that surrounds the house, which was designed by Humphrey Repton. They begin to rewild it, and gradually this process is extended to the surrounding farmland. It's a fascinating book. It's full of information and history. It's really very inspiring. And I think it's going to teach an awful lot of people important lessons for the future, given the degradation of our soil and the decline in insects and everything else. So a really seminal book. As I say, it is dense, and it's not a terribly easy read, but I think it's an important one.
So interesting. Yeah. So as you say, a Repton landscape. Mm. It's a thing
to all lose. Starts with the oaks that he planted are beginning to suffer because the ground around them has been intensely cultivated. And so oaks that should have another 300 years or so are dead, beginning to die. And that's a tree man comes to see them, and that's what sets them off on the voyage.
So thank you. I think that is about all we have time for this month.
Sadly it is, but Ursula and Matt, thank you both very much indeed for coming along. It's been so nice being able to talk about one of my favourite subjects.
Oh, we enjoyed it too, I think.
Very much.
As always, you can find details of all the books and authors we've mentioned today. They're in the show notes attached to this episode of the podcast on your app, or indeed on the website. That's foxedquarterly.com. We'll be back on August the 15th with a podcast all about literary festivals, a timely subject for high summer. Thank you for listening and for joining us on another bookish expedition off the beaten track.